cases Carnegie Mellon. Ms. Sullivan, you want 25 and 5?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead and start when you like.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Kathleen Sullivan for Marvell. We respectfully urge the Court to reverse the judgment below because CMU's patent claims are invalid as anticipated by Wurstel and because Marvell does not infringe them. But alternatively, we respectfully request that you, at a minimum, remand for a new trial on damages because no reasonable jury could have found that 50 cents a chip on worldwide sales represents a reasonable royalty for any domestic infringing use of CMU's claims. I'd like to cover invalidity very briefly, if I may. It boils down to two very simple points, Your Honors. Wurstel anticipates both limitations in the CMU claims. The key limitations are that there be a set of signal-dependent branch metric functions and that be applied to a plurality of signal samples. You need look no further than the plain language of Wurstel to find both of those limitations disclosed. I'd respectfully refer you to Wurstel column 10, line 52. That's where you get the set of signal-dependent branch metric functions.
That seems for all the world to say that there is a single standard deviation base number. Doesn't matter whether it's squared or not. I don't care about that. But it's a single one used for every single column in the trellis. Assume that that's signal dependent, which I'm prepared to assume. I'm going to assume here that set actually means plurality rather than a trivial set. So how have we gotten to two?
Greater than, Your Honor. The disclosure at line 52 is that the fraction derived from sigma will be greater for the one branches than the zero branches. That means there's going to be two equations. It doesn't matter if you multiply the zero branches by one.
That may mean that you are selecting among functions based on a signal. That doesn't mean that what you select in the zero branches is a signal-dependent metric.
Well, Your Honor,
it seems to be, and I think this is the idea in the testimony, that you select for the zeros a non-signal-dependent function, namely equation 20, which is not signal-dependent, I think your own witness said about four times, and you select for the ones something that is signal-dependent, but because it's constant, it doesn't vary from time slot to time slot.
But, Your Honor, Column 10, line 52 discloses is that there'll be a difference between the function for the ones and the zero, the one branches and the zero branches. And if I could refer, Your Honor, in column 10, the key equation 20 is the starting point. But column 10 asks that you further modify. What Wurstel does is he further modifies the modified branch metric function.
By multiplying by some number dependent on the standard deviation.
Yes, Your Honor, but the standard deviation expressing the transition noise is going to differ between the zero branches and the one branches, and it's that that produces the plurality and is the set. The fraction, it doesn't matter if you keep the zero branches constant or multiply them by one, the comparison to the one branches is going to yield two different equations, two different functions, because the sigma fraction is going to differ for the one branches and the zero branches. Your Honor, as to the plurality, that's our argument, and we would just respectively suggest that CMU's own expert conceded both that transition noise is a form of signal-dependent noise and that the column 10 discloses a set. All he disagreed about is whether both equations in the set were signal-dependent. We believe that's impossible to argue when he's conceded transition noise, which is measured on both branches, is signal dependent. So, Your Honor, that's the invalidity argument in nutshell.
Just to be clear about one thing, you're not suggesting that the sigma referred to, I guess not by letter, but standard deviation in column 10, is one that is being updated over time. It is, in fact, the same number that is being used as a multiplier against the rest of the, against equation 20, everywhere you have a one branch.
Correct, Your Honor, but the difference is between the one branches and the zero branches, okay. And that's the set. And, Your Honor, as to plurality, again, it's simple from the plain language of the patent, column 12, line, beginning at lines 48. The modified metric, and this by this he's referring to the further modified metric, takes into account not only a presently sampled input signal, but a previously sampled signal as well. So, Your Honor, on invalidity, we respectfully suggest that it was not a matter of a battle of the experts. The plain language of Wurstel, coupled with McLaughlin's admissions with respect to Wurstel, makes a case for invalidity.
If I could just stay on Wurstel for a second. It talks about transition noise. What do you understand transition noise to mean?
We understand it to mean signal-dependent noise.
Well, I know that, but let's just talk about this spec and what Wurstel means when he's talking about transition noise. Is that talking about when you go from a first bit to a second bit, if you flip the plurality on the second bit compared to the first bit, then there will be some resulting noise at the transition on the flip of the plurality?
Yes, Your Honor. And that where there's no transition, the noise will be different from the noise when there is a transition.
So I guess I'm wondering, why is that signal-dependent noise based on the claim construction provided for signal-dependent noise, which was a noise structure attributable to a specific sequence of symbols, e.g. written symbols. So why is the flip of plurality between two bits the same thing as a specific sequence of symbols?
Because the bits are the transition or no transition is expressed in a series of bits, ones and zeros, and we believe those are covered by the term symbols.
But why is symbols the same thing as bits? Because when I look at the 839 patent and I try to understand what the disclosure says, it repeatedly makes reference to symbols and written symbols with reference to these funny symbols that say plus, plus with a circle around it, minus, minus with a circle around it. And so what the 839 patent is telling me is that when it's talking about a specific sequence of symbols, it's talking about those particular pluses and minuses which represent transitions between two different bits. So now I'm beginning to wonder if the best understanding of the claim construction is it's referring to a noise structure attributable to a specific sequence of transitions. And what Wurstel is trying to remedy is noise at a single transition. So do you see why I'm now seeing that there is daylight between Wurstel as disclosed on its face and my understanding of what is being claimed when the claim references signal dependent?
Your Honor, I do see your point, but the claim construction did not construe a symbol as narrowly as you described. And there's nothing to suggest that the transition noise equations that are disclosed in Wurstel don't themselves embody a sequence of symbols, because the bits represented by 1 and 0 on the transition branches and the non-transition branches, we think that does fit within the term symbol as construed.
Yeah, but Dr. McLaughlin talked about how all Wurstel has is a single transition, and that's not the same thing as a specific sequence of written symbols. And I didn't see anything by Dr. Proakis countering that by saying, well, Wurstel is really more than just about a particular transition of a flip of plurality between two bits. It could actually be more expansive than that, and that's really what Wurstel is contemplating. It's contemplating a sequence of transitions, which would require more than two bits. It would require at least three bits.
Your Honor, that is a possible reading of Wurstel. But at a minimum here, our interpretation of Wurstel renders the willfulness judgment here inappropriate, because we certainly had an objectively reasonable defense because there's ambiguity in the term symbol, and because we reasonably believed that there was a set of signal-dependent branch metric functions, and we reasonably believe that it was applied to a plurality of signals. And the further details of the CMU patents are not necessarily relevant to the particular claims at issue here. There may be other differences between Wurstel and CMU. In fact, Wurstel himself said there might be some differences, but the claims here are really quite simple, and set of signal-dependent functions and plurality of signal samples we think are covered by the plain terms.
What do you think Mr. Wurstel meant when he said that this work by Kavchik goes above and beyond Wurstel's own work?
We don't know, Your Honor, but as narrowed for trial, the covariance matrices dropped out of the case, and to the extent that covariance matrices were what CMU pointed to as part of the complexity of their analysis, that may have been what he was referring to, but we don't think...
And he fully reviewed the work at that point?
No, Your Honor. He had just reviewed the disclosures. So, Your Honor, if I could, because I really do want to focus on the damages issues in the case, be extremely brief about non-infringement. Again, I want to suggest that, at a minimum, we had an objectively reasonable non-infringement defense.
I'm sorry, just real quickly, one last quick question on validity, and maybe I didn't catch it in your first colloquy with Judge Toronto. You go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, non-infringement, very quickly. MNP chips perform the analysis in a post-processor, not in the trellis. You might say, why does the analysis have to be in the trellis? The answer is the court's construction, to which CMU stipulated, of the term branch, which modifies both branch metric function and branch metric value.
Am I remembering right or wrong that there was a quite substantial dispute in the claim construction process about whether the post-processor was going to be excluded or not, and the court ruled against Marvell and for CMU. In what way are you making a point different from what was resolved
rejected
against you?
Your Honor, simply that to include the post-processor in the application of the function is incorrect under the stipulated claim construction about branch, because branch is defined as a transition between two nodes or states in a trellis. And that's confirmed, of course, by Kavchik's admission that his claims operate in the trellis and not in the post-processor. So, Your Honor, however we draw the line around the thing that is doing the detection, we think the application step has to be performed in the trellis by virtue of the claim construction of branch. On the NLD chips, the argument is very straightforward. CMU's claims both require application to a plurality of signal samples. Our branch metric function, which is in the chip stipulation, so it's part of the technical documents that are binding in the case on both parties, applies the branch metric function to a signal sample that's outputted by the prefilter, and that's represented by the parameter F sub Y. So no plurality there. And finally, on simulations, Your Honor, we would respectfully suggest that simulations are not covered by the claims. If you look at the...
Can I just ask you about that? It seems to me that the patent itself makes clear, contrary to a kind of ordinary English reaction to the word detector, that this is not a sensor of the magnetic properties of the hard drive. It is, in fact, a data detector, which is why it's separated from the sensor in Figure 1, at which point, and I gather there's evidence of this, that you get data from actual hard drives and then feed it into the processor, the Viterbi-like processor. It doesn't matter whether you call that a computer or not. It's still a relevant detector because it's detecting the data by running a process to figure out what the true bits were.
Correct, Your Honor, but in real time. And in fact, the opening of the 839 patent says that the patent is directed to high-density magnetic recording sequence detectors, and other aspects of the claims that we detail in the brief refer to the notion of a real-time hard drive data detector, not a simulation using a computer. And the admission, again, of CMU's own expert confirms that reading of the patent, because McLaughlin admitted that the detector is in the chip. And we further suggest that, if CMU now wants to say, well, this is just an algorithm, it would run into Alice problems, because if it's just a patent ineligible mathematical equation that doesn't have a structure, we think it would run into problems of eligibility. But, Your Honors, I would like, if I could, because they're complex, to spend the rest of my time on the damages issues. And I'd like to begin by simply, let's break it out into the base and the rate. And let me begin with the problems with the royalty base. And I'd like to begin with the instruction, because that's what we think is the root of the problem here. The judge instructed the jury that it was entitled to include, as a proxy for the domestic infringing use, all sales, including all foreign sales, all sales of chips manufactured, sold, and used abroad, all sales, including foreign sales, quote, resulting from Marvell's alleged infringing use during the sales cycle. Now, the problem with that
instruction... Wasn't there another place in the instruction that said you can't award damages based on the foreign sales?
That's correct. In the preceding sentence, Your Honor, the court
right.
instructs, you may not award damages on the basis of the foreign sales, but it goes on to say you may consider all sales resulting from Marvell's alleged infringing use during the sales cycle as a means of valuing the domestic infringing use. So she says you can't literally award damages for the foreign sales, but you can use foreign sales as part of the royalty base for creating this proxy for the valuation of the domestic infringing use in the sales cycle. Now, there's two problems with this, Your Honor. I'd like to start with the first problem. By including foreign sales at all, we believe it violates the long line of precedents by which this court and other courts have said, as a matter of law, that you may not recover U.S. patent damages for foreign sales. It doesn't matter if it's direct or indirect. If they're in the base, they're being used as a basis for calculation here. And obviously there are...
By the way, do you generally agree that the law is different in the copyright world?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor.
I thought there were quite a number of cases cited, Fourth Circuit, Second Circuit, Ninth Circuit, others that allow the use of foreign sales to calculate copyright damages for domestic activity as long as the former followed from the latter.
So, Your Honor, the argument in the patent context is that the territoriality principle for patent law, which may well be different from that for copyright law, requires that a U.S. patent rights holder does not obtain, in a sense, the value of a worldwide license. Now, I want to just say that there isn't a single case that CMU can cite in the patent context, as opposed to the copyright context, that suggests this kind of fruit of the poisonous tree theory that lets you get out to and reach out to the foreign sales. And Power Integrations is just the latest statement of this. Power Integrations obviously has some differences from this case.
That's right. That's what I'm wondering. Is it likewise true that there's no case on this kind of fact pattern going the other way in your favor? I feel like what we have here is something of an in-between case.
I agree, Your Honor. I think there is no clear case either way. And what we would respectfully suggest is that you should make clear in this case that the principle of Power Integrations, which of course expresses a long line of territoriality cases in the patent context, requires you to send the case back for a new trial with an instruction that excludes the foreign chips from the royalty base. Now, let me say why. I think the closest case to our side is Power Integrations. And I think the reason for that is Power Integrations obviously involved an apparatus patent where sales were potential acts of infringement, where a method patent, the infringement here is used. That, in our view, makes no difference, because what this court rejected in Power Integrations was the idea that mere proximate causation or reasonable foreseeability was enough to allow the patent holder to reach out into foreign jurisdictions and include the foreign chips in the base. We think what happened here is even worse. Power Integrations at least involved a proximate causation notion about reasonable foreseeability. Here the instruction is just a but-for causation instruction. It says you, the jury, can use foreign sales as a proxy for domestic infringing use if they resulted from. There's no qualification. If they resulted from, there's no definition. And that's the second error here, Your Honor.
Can you explain what's the nature of these sales cycles? I mean, if you win a sales cycle, does that mean that you know, you and your customer are essentially attached at the hip for the next 4 or 5 years and are going to be making billions of dollars together? I mean, how does it exactly work? What are they agreeing to when there is a sales cycle win?
Your Honor, the answer to that question is the record does not say. The record does not say for a very basic reason. We sought at many points pre-trial and during the trial to exclude evidence of foreign sales as part of the royalty base. That was denied, and the court repeatedly ruled, both in pre-trial motions in limine and in response to our trial objections, that all sales, including foreign sales, could come into the case. So there was never an opportunity for the jury to decide what does a sales cycle mean, where did the sales take place. There was never any joining of issue on that because the court's instructions precluded a definition of the sales cycle or a definition of where the sales took place, and that's an additional reason
but
for you to remand.
There was lots of talk about design wins.
There was, Your Honor.
When a design win occurs, is there a contract?
The record does not say, Your Honor. There was no evidence in the record that established where contracts were signed.
Never mind where. Is there a contract when Seagate agrees with Marvell, we're going to use your chip? Is that embodied in a contract?
Yes, Your Honor. But the evidence in the record.
So, and what is the is it a requirements contract? Are there minimum numbers?
Your Honor, I can't answer that because it's not in the record. And I think this is one of the central reasons why you need to send it back. I mean, I could try to give you answers from personal knowledge, but that isn't the point. The point here is that the record does not have any evidence of what sales cycle means, where the contracts took place, and as this court made clear recently in HALO, a mere offer in the United States is certainly not enough to establish that a sale took place in the United States. You might want evidence about where contracts were signed, where sales were made. So, Your Honor, two separate problems with the instruction. One is it included foreign sales. You have repeatedly said as a matter of law that foreign sales can't be the basis for determining a royalty base. And you asked what case we had. The closest case for us is Power Integrations. The only case for them, Your Honor, is Railroad Dynamics. And we think that Railroad Dynamics is a case that allows the inclusion in a royalty base of some foreign sales of car sets containing infringing snubber components. But it does so in the only context in which you have ever approved the use of foreign sales as part of the royalty base, and that is where the infringing car sets were domestically manufactured and the infringement.
If the underlying concern about extraterritoriality as a common sense matter is trying to prevent duplicative regulation, why doesn't the railroad case present exactly that problem? The making and the selling, where the making is here and the selling is abroad, and the two countries may have quite different regimes or even the same regime and want to tax it twice with damages, and yet that's okay.
It does present it, Your Honor, and we don't necessarily believe Railroad Dynamics would survive this court's approach in Power Integrations, which suggested that the extraterritorial principle should trump the principle of fair compensation, and for the reasons that you described. So I'm not suggesting Railroad Dynamics is correct. I'm just saying that to the extent it's still good law, it doesn't apply to our case, because in our case you've got a long attenuated chain of causation between the domestic act of infringement, the use of demonstration chips and simulations in Santa Clara to create a relationship that becomes contractual at some point not specified in the record. That's very different. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the infringing manufacturer and Railroad Dynamics and all the other cases that CMU has cited for this principle. And the
there
foreign
are times
sale.
Where there's a sales cycle win that ultimately there's a breakdown on the way to ultimate sale and manufacture and incorporation of the chips?
We do, Your Honor. It's undisputed in this case that the chips are all manufactured in a foundry in Taiwan that was conceded by CMU's own expert. We also believe that when Power Integration said that the act of foreign sale, manufacture, or use creates an intervening cause that breaks the chain of causation, there is a real problem with this kind of case. The reason why the car set might be understood as an acceptable proxy is that the car set is not a consequence of the infringement in the United States. It's literally a measure on a one-to-one basis of the infringement in the United States because the thing is completed before it leaves our borders. We think that our case is dispositively different from Railroad Dynamics, and it would take a new carve-out from the territoriality principle for this court to affirm. I see my time is nearly up. I wonder if I could switch to the royalty rate and just briefly make a few quick points. I'm sorry, Your Honor. On the base, there may be one more thing to say, if I can interrupt myself. On the base, I made the argument about what's wrong with the instruction. It includes foreign sales, and the resulting from the but-for causation piece is undefined. The court compounded the error by not saying what the sales cycle means, and the parties were precluded from inputting evidence on where sales took place, an additional reason for remand. But on the base, I just want to say why a reasonable...
I'm sorry, I just want to follow up on one thing, though I'm not sure it matters. I was not seeing a preclusion of evidence on the question of where the sales took place.
Your Honor, the
there was
district
a
court...
a summary judgment in which I think, I forget the citation, I thought the district court said near the end, this question is an issue for trial.
The district court repeatedly said, I'm letting all sales come in regardless of place, and we regard that as effectively precluding or rendering futile.
Oh, so you're equating those two.
Yes, we are.
Okay, I'm not sure I would. Okay, go on.
Fair enough, Your Honor. On the base, just one last quick point. Even if you think this instruction is acceptable, we don't. We think you must remand for a new trial, giving clarifying principles about foreign sales and the causation standard. No reasonable jury could have found that the foreign sales would have been included in a hypothetical negotiation in this case. So just on the record here, three quick points. The parties must be assumed to bargain in the hypothetical negotiation in the shadow of the law. CMU had no evidence of any analog foreign patents here. So CMU was not in a position in the hypothetical negotiation here to bargain for a worldwide license. Second quick point, there was no industry practice data or any other real-world data point in this case whatsoever to suggest that percentage of worldwide sales was ever the kind of license given in this industry for this kind of venture project of a university. To the contrary, as I won't belabor, all of the real-world evidence in this case, such as the $200,000 a year offered Intel...
It does have this seemingly quite appealing economic rationale of everybody... getting money if the thing turns out to be a success, and you're getting basically three-quarters of it, and they're getting one-quarter when the alternative is maybe much, much worse for you.
Your Honor, there's no evidence Marvell would have signed a license that's 600 or 6,000 times more expensive for it than it could have gotten by joining the DSSC or taking the deal offered to Intel or taking the deal, the $2 million annual deal that CMU said post the date of the hypothetical negotiation, 2004, 2005, CMU says, a great optimistic scenario would be $2 million from Marvell. So there's no evidence that the willing licensor here would have contemplated this license. And there's no evidence that the willing licensee here would have contemplated it, because if Marvell was faced with paying 600 or 6,000 times the nearest historical license, it could have moved offshore for the chip cycle. Your Honor, I see I'm almost out of time for my rebuttal. On the rate point, we've covered it in our brief, but I can cover it briefly if Your Honor wants, or I can save it for rebuttal.
What about, just if I could move on or go back for a second. So you're basically saying the hypothetical negotiation would be restricted to actual U.S. usages and sales.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what about Ms. Lawton's reference to a calculation that resulted in something like 556 million chips making it back onto U.S.
Yes,
stores?
Your Honor.
So I guess that would be something that you would agree is an infringement.
Well, I don't agree with that, Your Honor, but first may I ask, Your Honor, may I preserve my rebuttal time if I answer Judge Chen's question?
we'll give you 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you. The answer to that, Judge Chen, is we don't concede that if the sales cycle begins in Santa Clara, the manufacturer and sale occurs abroad and the chips come back into the United States, we don't concede that that necessarily is a proper piece of the royalty base. We don't concede it because there's been intervening causes. But, Your Honor, on this record, there was also a contributory and induced infringement verdict. And so the notion that the chips that come back into the United States might be fairly encompassed by a secondary liability theory, might allow you to sustain that piece of the verdict. But then at most, the liability would be for the domestic, the chips that are that come back into the country. We don't think the evidence on that was proper. It was based on industry-wide PC data and not data specific to Marvell. There's a lower number that's more data specific, 329 million chips. But, Your Honor, we don't concede, of course, we don't concede infringement, but we don't concede that causation that takes a round trip out of the country and back in is necessarily proper. You'd have to ask, what is that the direct and immediate result? Do we want to extend causal chains that far to include it for direct infringement? So to summarize, we don't concede on direct infringement. You might sustain those chips here if you had a contributory or induced infringement theory. But, Your Honor, the last point on rates, we've said in our brief that the rates should be... Thank you, Your Honor. If I have things to address on the rates, I'll thank you very much, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Josh Rosenkranz representing Carnegie Mellon University. Your Honors, if I may, I'd like to take an unconventional approach and begin with damages first and then circle back to the merits and, in particular, willfulness. But just to frame it all up in one package, this case truly is extraordinary, but not for the reasons that Marvell has recounted. You almost never see copying as blatant or as reckless as this. You almost never see a case where the accused infringer has admitted and never argued that it has anything by way of a non-infringing alternative. You almost never see such a stark before and after picture of a company struggling in a life and death struggle, about to go out of business, and then rising to the top of the market where the company itself says that the reason is this particular invention.
Right, but on the damages point, in particular the extraterritoriality point, that point at least I take it to be independent of any questioning of the tightness of the causation from all of the activity in, is it Santa Clara? Is that where it is?
Yes, Your Honor.
In Santa Clara and Taiwan and other places that the resulting chips were made and delivered and most of them used. Why is it that even if your basic narrative is accepted that the alternative to infringement here was Marvell going out of business and the amount of 25% of their multi-billion dollar profit resulting is a reasonable price to pay, nevertheless, the extraterritoriality argument is you've reached too far.
I understood, Your Honor. And actually, the narrative links directly to extraterritoriality. Not just was it necessary for Marvell to infringe to save its life, it was necessary for Marvell to infringe in Silicon Valley. That was part of the no non-infringing alternative. And that makes this case the diametric opposite of Power Integrations. In Power Integrations, there was absolutely no linkage between the domestic act of sales and the foreign sales.
I thought I read Power Integrations differently, where the opinion, at least, rejected the theory of awarding damages on foreign sales that were connected to or related to or caused by domestic infringement.
No, Your Honor, actually the word was foreseeable. I mean, it was a completely crackpot theory of damages in that case. There were domestic sales, and the plaintiff said, because it was foreseeable that there would be foreign sales, we get to claw back the lost sales that we would have made in foreign territories. And this court went out of its way to say that the expert admitted that his damages estimate was, quote, not actually rooted in the defendant's activity in the United States, was, quote, not related to any parts that were manufactured, used, or sold in the United States. So to segue back to Judge Toronto's question, here we have that definitive linkage. This may be the unique case, the extraordinary case, where that linkage is very clear, precisely because here is where the sales force was. here's where the design force was, 150 Marvell design employees out of 153. Here's where the customers and their design centers were. They had no choice but to be infringing for trillions of times per chip over the course of millions of chips, hand in hand over the course of several years for each design win.
In the red brief, you describe the patents in suit as must-have cutting-edge technology. Does every other chip use it? Have you sued other chip manufacturers?
The answer to the first question is yes. Every other chip in a hard drive has it, according to our industry expert, Bioric. It's become industry standard. Everyone's asking for it.
So you've sued all other...
The answer to the second question is no, we haven't sued. It was a big lift to sue Marvell. Now, understand that the reason it took so long to sue Marvell is because you can't, like, pry open the chip and see that someone's infringing. You have to actually get their documents to figure out the nature of the infringement. Now, I want to turn to Judge Chan's question about what the record says about a design win, because it supplies the rest of the nexus. It is a winner-take-all market, and on page 42-124, you have a clear quote from our industry expert that says, when you win, you get all the chips on the drive in that generation. He says that he's never heard of a case where some other chip gets put into the drive once you get the design win. So yes, Judge Toronto, it is like a requirements contract.
Oh, but we don't actually have a record either containing the contract or saying Seagate or Western Digital or the other four customers or something, they commit to buying either a certain amount or everything that they're going to use when they make hard drives for a certain period.
Agreed. The best that we have is 42-124 on line 4. This is our industry expert, and so, to my knowledge, no drive company has ever taken two rechannel suppliers to production on the same drive, on the same generation, at the same time. That essentially says, winner take all.
Is there a reason why there was no contract
evidence
or partnership entered into the record that reflects what are the terms of the agreement between Marvell and...
Well, so I would say Marvell completely punted on the question of where the sales occur. We put into the record that we were all about uses. It was a winner-take-all market. We had clear testimony about that. Marvell is saying worldwide sales. The district court said Marvell did not produce any evidence that there were sales anywhere but in Silicon Valley. This was a design win. The design win was the sale, and the district court said that not only that, but that there was but-for cause established between the infringement and the design win.
In the red brief at 61, you say Lawton testified that both Marvell and CMU frequently entered into running royalty agreements around the time of the hypothetical negotiation. I couldn't find any evidence in the record to support that assertion.
Well, Your Honor, I've got pages 43, 335-36 where Lawton talks about it, and 34024 where Arms...
I looked at what you had in the brief, but it didn't seem to me to support it. Do you have in the way of other proof?
Well, Your Honor, the three licenses that were put in the record were all licenses on the same exact chips, the systems on chips that our technology was incorporated into, and all three of them were what Ms. Sullivan refers to as worldwide sales. It was the sale of all chips. And that makes total sense, as Judge Toronto was saying, as an economic matter. Marvell doesn't even track where the chips end up or where its customers end up using the chips. What Marvell cares about, and what in this hypothetical negotiation the parties would care about, is that it's a winner-take-all design market and the infringement had to happen here, so let's share in the proceeds that come from that. Now, I do want to talk...
I want to talk to you about 50 cents per chip.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So, the sales to the particular company, I don't know what's confidential on here or not, so I'm just going to...
I think it's all free.
Okay. So So the sales to Maxter of about 137,000 chips, which were included in Ms. Lawton's analysis, were associated with an operating premium of 47 cents. And those figures were from 2003 to 2004. But Ms. Lawton says, in this industry, the price is always going down. So why is 50 cents a chip royalty reasonable at the time of the negotiation?
Well, so, Your Honor, a few things to say about it. First, the same licenses that I mentioned are per-chip licenses. Marvell said, we don't really care much about the form of the license. What matters is on a case-by-case basis, how much money we're going to make, the difference between 50 cents a chip or a certain percentage. But the other thing that Ms. Lawton testifies to is, yes, the chip prices are going down. Why? Because as you manufacture more, the cost goes down. The operating premium goes up. The operating profits go up as the costs go down because you actually make more profit per chip. And so that's why it's reasonable. And the only question here then becomes whether her methodology is reasonable or, more specifically, whether the district court erred in adopting, in approving of her methodology as a matter of abuse of discretion. But before we get too deeply in the 50 cent per chip, and I'm happy to go back, I do want to make one other point about the question I think Judge Chin asked about whether there is a different standard in the Copyright Act rather than the Patent Act.
That was Judge Toronto.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Toronto.
I'm sure we're both interested in the answer.
So the answer is no. There is one rule of extraterritoriality. The Copyright Act has that rule in it. It is called the Predicate Act Doctrine. The Predicate Act Doctrine says that when you when the Predicate Act here is the infringement, that's what is necessary for it to occur in the United States. But in keeping with Gould's and Railroad Dynamics, once you have that Predicate Act in the United States, you are allowed to measure damages based upon benefit. The classic way of measuring benefit is based upon sales. And it doesn't matter. Once you are allowed to measure based even on non-infringing sales, it simply doesn't matter why the sales don't infringe, whether they don't infringe because this is a method patent and that's an apparatus, or because this is a patent on domestic use and the ultimate sales were not infringing because they were foreign.
So do you think in a case like Microsoft versus AT&T, where the Supreme Court said all of those foreign uses and sales are not infringing, the Supreme Court nevertheless would have said it's okay to sweep in all of those sales into a reasonable royalty negotiation?
Yes, not only would the Supreme Court say it, but the Supreme Court did say it in Gould's. In Gould's, the act of infringement was domestic. And what the plaintiff was allowed to get were royalties on the foreign sales as well.
I have to ask it again because I want to make sure you say it again.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of millions of sales of Windows abroad that the Supreme Court ruled do not infringe, those would nevertheless be considered in a reasonable royalty negotiation between AT&T and Microsoft?
If there is the clear nexus that we have established here between the domestic uses and the sales, regardless of where they were. And again, I have to emphasize, there's no evidence in this record that the sales were abroad. The district court went out of its way to say...
Right, the district court did, but you, I thought, quite conspicuously say practically nothing about that point in your brief. All you do on page 83 is quote JA 250, where the district court's conclusion, but you don't make the argument that, in fact, under normal location of sales principles, which I realize are not complete, given the footnote in HALO, that nevertheless these sales actually did occur in the United States.
We didn't for lack of space, but that is clearly true.
Whatever the reason.
You know, no, but that is clearly true. We are not distancing ourselves from what the district court said. The location of these sales, the only thing we've got in this record is that the sales, that is, from Marvell to its customers, were not just negotiated, not just designed, not just priced out, but consummated in the United States. But the reason we don't make much of that is because our theory was not about where the sales were consummated. Our theory was about the domestic uses. And the domestic uses were essential. I mean, we're not talking about an extravagant theory here. We're talking about an extraordinary, possibly unique linkage where everything that happened in the United States over the course of 3 to 4 years per cycle, every act of infringement, had to happen in the United States, precisely because that's where Marvell's customers are, that's where the design centers are.
Just so I understand it, I have to think about only the question of whether it was permissible to award this kind of damages based on this causation theory of the direct infringement related to the testing, designing, in the sales cycle. And I don't have to ask the other question of whether or not all of these sales of these 10 billion chips actually happened in the United States.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. Our theory was not about where the sales were. Our theory under Minko and Spectralytics and Union Carbide is once you have the active infringement, once you have an active infringement, you can value the benefit to the infringer based upon the resulting sales, even though in every one of those cases, the sales were not infringing. And when you marry those cases with Gould's and especially Railroad Dynamics says when you've got the active infringement in the United States, you are allowed to get, you are allowed to measure benefit based upon the non-infringing sales, including the non-infringing sales in other countries.
Can I ask you this? Suppose, for purposes of this question, that we were to think that the jury instruction was improper on extraterritoriality grounds and that a new trial was needed as a result because we don't know if the jury found on any other basis. In such a new trial, I take it your position would be that at that point there could be a much more well-joined evidentiary dispute about location of sales?
Yes, there could be, but I need to emphasize one point about your hypothetical, Your Honor.
I realize you disagree.
But even if the court were to conclude that, let's just be clear on what instructions were on the table. There was our instruction, the resulting from instruction, which comes directly out of, for example, this court's opinion in King Instruments, which we didn't cite, but it says resulting from, or Marvell's instruction, which is sole cause, only cause, which is even more extreme than an EMVR instruction. So
what's the law on the question? If their instruction was incorrect, but so was yours, and yours was adopted, do they get to get a reversal?
They don't, Your Honor. What they get is the benefit.
Wait a second. If the jury's improperly, you're saying the jury was improperly instructed, but forget about it?
What I'm saying is if, hypothetically, the court concludes that the jury had the wrong instruction, and the reason it was wrong is because it should have been a but-for instruction. And Marvell never asked for a but-for instruction. Absolutely, Marvell waived that argument.
No. Suppose that the error is it needed to have some sort of territorial limit in it. Is that preserved or waived or what?
It depends what the territorial limit was. I mean, Marvell's objection was that the district court erred in saying the act of infringement has to occur in the United States. That is what the district court said. Do not count as infringement.
But it's the next sentence that they have
right,
to.
But you can count, yes, that's preserved, but you can count all sales, the entire benefit. Now, that comes directly out of Gould's and Railroad Dynamics, this notion that you count the benefit of all non-infringing sales. And by the way, that's exactly how parties would be negotiating, which is what we've already discussed.
Well, except that the hypothetical negotiation is hypothetical in a number of ways. It's not tied to the specific parties, as we recently said, and not completely tied. It's somewhat related to the position of the particular parties, but not completely tied otherwise. For various reasons. It's also under a set of hypothetical assumptions, including everybody knows that this patent is infringed, everybody knows that it's valid, And the question, I guess, is why isn't another one of those hypothetical constraints you may negotiate only about intraterritorial activity, whatever that may mean?
So, I was with you.
Even if the extraterritorial is tied at the hip in a causation way to the domestic activity.
I was with you up until that last sentence. Sure, you're negotiating about infringement in the United States. That's what the Predicate Act doctrine is about. That's the only doctrine that the Supreme Court has ever used when it talks about extraterritoriality. I mean, Marvell has never cited a single case that has said damages need to be limited or the benefit needs to be measured only with respect to acts that, only with respect to sales that are domestic. I mean, Sheldon, which is versus MGM, which is the learned hand opinion that talks about the Predicate Act doctrine, that was about making of a negative in the United States. But what ended up happening because the negative was made in the United States and exported abroad was all these copies were made abroad. Those acts were all abroad, but because the benefit to the infringer infringed here, and because the benefit to the infringer is measured by sales, the act of infringement is measured by all of those sales. So to reach a different conclusion here would mean that the court has to conclude that there's a special patent law rule governing extraterritoriality that doesn't apply in any other context. Now, I did promise to
Hang on a minute. At page 50 in the blue brief, the argument is made that, I think you probably agree, that at least actual licenses are probative evidence of the proper form of the royalty structure. And then they go on to say the only evidence of any contemporaneous actual licensing was flat fee. Okay. And I wrote a note to say I think that's right, but I wanted to give you a chance to discuss it.
Well, so what I think they say is that the only evidence with respect to these specific patents...
They say the only evidence of any contemporaneous actual licensing showed that CMU contemplated and received flat fee sums rather than permanent royalties.
That's false, Your Honor. We put into evidence...
That's why I wanted you to... Okay,
yes, so. we put into evidence a license that was a running royalty. It was a 1998 license. It wasn't on this specific patent. But I need to underscore that Ms. Lawton did consider all of those other licenses, and she concluded, in the words of the district court, that they are radically different. There is a huge difference between, on the one hand, a license that you provide to what are essentially partners in a joint venture. Let's go together and figure out how to solve these problems. It'll cost you $250,000 a year to be a member, but you're also giving hundreds of millions of dollars worth of research support and participating in the exercise of identifying and solving problems versus Marvell. And by the way, none of them actually know what you're going to invent. Of course,
is that, by the way, true of that last point in your last sentence, or the by the way point? Is that true of all of the licenses that
Marvell points
Marvell
to?
Relied on?
Yes, all of the DSSC,
pre-invention.
Yes, then there's the Intel offer. Now, the Intel offer was a completely different scenario. Intel was not in the read channel business, so Marvell went to Intel, said, "We know we have this license that is worthless to you, but it would mean a great deal to us if you would license it so we could announce to the world."
I'm sorry, that was post-invention.
That is post-invention, yes. Now, if it's okay, I did promise to turn to the merits. And in particular, I'll look at the merits through the lens of the willfulness, because...
I'm going to ask you just one question about a topic that Ms. Sullivan...
Of course.
Not bring up, but latches. Put aside for the minute our pending en banc proceeding. What do you do about the principal case?
Sotorevic.
Yes. Thank you for saying it. Which
I'm sure I mispronounced
it. Which I think says in terms and cites and quotes a few earlier decisions that say it is true that the defendant's bad conduct, inequitable conduct, can count against laches, but only if it is in some way responsible for the patent holder's delay. And we don't have that.
Well, so first, Your Honor, I don't believe Serdarevic cited other cases for that proposition, but it is an inventorship case, and this court's law in the infringement context is completely different.
Copying by itself can be an invention.
Yes, in the infringement context, and that's en banc, that's Aukerman, which says it explicitly. Conscious copying may be a factor weighing against the defendant. Gasser Chair, an explicit holding. Bot, an explicit holding. And the point is that inventorship actions are just different from infringement actions.
Why are they different?
Well, because in the inventorship context, if the inventor's clean, in the inventorship context, the inventor who is the defendant will always have unclean hands under that scenario. They will always know that they're cutting someone out of the action. And Serdarevic says, well, that means that you would never have you would never be able to survive a laches defense. Here we've got the opposite. In the infringement context, you can be a blatant infringer because you know about the patents, for example, as was the case here, or you could be someone who accidentally trips across the line. And, by the way, under Marvell's theory, no one would ever be able to present and win a laches claim because in the patent infringement context, the infringement, the copying, however egregious, is never the cause of the delay. But I keep promising to turn to the merits unless the court has more questions about laches. So the bottom line here is that these defenses were not just wrong, but as the jury and the district court both found, they were unreasonably wrong. Marvell's top infringement argument was all about drawing boxes on chip diagrams and saying, this is what you should focus on, don't focus on that, even when Marvell's own documents described the chip otherwise. And this, in answer to one of the questions that was asked, was exactly the argument that the district court raised and rejected in claim construction, the argument that Marvell is making.
The argument that it has to be done in a trellis?
Yes, yes. Exactly what the district court said. Don't give me the 7-word email.
Right, but the response to that, I think I'm remembering correctly, is nevertheless, the claim construction adopted requires that this calculation be done for the branch. And if it's being done for a branch, you're in the trellis. Metaphorically in the trellis.
So, okay, but then that leads to the argument, therefore it's got to be in, therefore a post-processor cannot work. Now, McLaughlin was very clear, our technical expert was very clear. It's going on in the trellis, in the MMP. Marvell kept pointing to, and if you look at page 15, of the opening brief, you've got this great diagram. And McLaughlin, this is of the MNP. It's what Marvell calls the MNP. It's what Marvell calls the detector. Marvell kept saying, look, it says Viterbi detector. It's going on in there, but it's not going on in the MNP. And McLaughlin kept saying, this is 46588. No, I'm talking about what's happening in the MNP. There's a second Viterbi detector with a second trellis. It's called a pruned trellis, and it's all actually going on in the MNP. Not that it matters, because this whole thing Marvell called the detector. And then as to validity, Marvell's position was simply to dependent upon rewriting a formula that our experts said is ridiculously misleading, rewriting it in a way that contradicted the plain language of the very column that Ms. Sullivan...
And just to check my understanding, the ridiculous aspect, I think you would say, of the rewriting was not using a variance instead of the standard deviation, but putting the index putting the in the subscript, indexing the subscript the sigma to suggest that it was differing from time to
absolutely.
Time and branch to branch.
Yes, the subscript is really small and really hard to see, but it didn't put one over on the jury or the district court. It is incredibly important. In column 10, it begins by saying on line 26, that sigma squared, it is a constant. It's 0.055. It could be something else, but it's a constant that he describes. And he goes further down in column 10, and he refers to it as a constant. And it is not different from branch to branch. And I have to emphasize...
Where do you refer to it as a constant?
Column 10, at the bottom of the... It's sort of the bottom paragraph. Line 55, by a fraction.
Which depends on the transition noise standard deviation.
Yes, correct. It's the... line 26, it's talking about the standard deviation, that being a fraction, 0.055. He's talking down here about each branch of the metric. So it's the same branches. They're all being multiplied by the same number. You could choose a number, a number, that is different from 0.055, but it's the same number for every branch. And I have to underscore that Ms. Sullivan just changed the theory of...
Which lines were you reading?
So the first line was column 10, line 26, and then when you go further...
This is in the unfurther modified example, right?
Yes, so that's the standard deviation. Standard deviation is a fraction, and then when you go down to the further modified, he's talking about the standard deviation. It's still a fraction, and it's further modified by multiplying by a scalar. It's a fraction. It could be sigma squared. It could be sigma. It could be sigma squared for all we care. But it's the same fraction every time it's multiplied. And I do want to underscore that the theory of infringement changed today. Marvell admitted in the district court, so there are two equations. There's equation 20, and there's the equation 20 that's multiplied by a constant. Okay? One can call them two, they are two different equations, arguably. Marvell and its expert admitted in the district court, equation 20 is not signal dependent. And our whole argument was, well, if equation 20 is not signal dependent, you can't make it signal dependent by multiplying it by a fraction. And Ms. Sullivan today said, and so Marvell's entire theory was, no, it is the further modified equation. That's the one that represents the set, precisely because of this B, NT. That's the set. Ms. Sullivan today just said, no, that equation 20 is further modified is not the set. The set is equation 20. That's one element of the set. The second element of the set is the further modified.
And which one you choose depends on the particular value, whether it's a 1 or a 0, whether it's a transition or not.
Which one you choose depends upon whether...
So the selection is signal dependent, though what you select in half the cases is...
So no, Your Honor, because a transition is not the same as a sequence of symbols. So you can tell that there has been a transition.
But is that a different... point. I thought you disagreed, even assuming that a particular transition is a signal and a function that you apply when you have that signal is signal dependent. Even if you assume that when you apply exactly the same thing to all of the transitions and don't to the zeros, that the choice based on signal does not make what you choose into something signal-dependent. So at the end of the day, you still have just one signal-dependent function.
I would say yes to that, but I am making
To the extent I made clear what
I know. I think you were very clear, but I have an open. But it's also an additional argument, which is being able to detect a transition, which is what in column one is described as the prior art, which is no good. That is not the same as being able to detect a sequence of signals because, per the conversation that Judge Chen was having with Ms. Sullivan, being able to detect whether it's a transition only tells you whether it's It doesn't tell you whether it's north to north or south to south. Whether it's north to north or south to south depends upon the sequence of symbols, and the district court's unappealed claim construction was that the signal-dependent branch metric function has to be able to determine the sequence of signals.
Better wrap it up.
Symbols, I should say.
Better wrap it up.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. You've been very patient, and we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court in all respects.
I'm going to give you 6 minutes, Ms. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Judge Toronto, you asked my friend if you corrected the erroneous instruction and sent the case back for remand, could a robust evidentiary record be joined on the meaning of sales cycle and the location of the sales? And the answer is absolutely yes. It could be, and it has been, in post-Marvell cases like the France Telecom case just finished in the Northern District of California. There was no evidence to support my friend's assertions about sales actually taking place in the United States or a sales cycle necessarily being located in the United States. There was no evidence to suggest that Marvell didn't have non-infringing alternatives out of the country.
I took it from the district court's three or so pages, around 248 to 250 of the joint appendix, that no evidence was really on your side. There was plenty of testimony that said all the negotiations took place, these were design wins. The point that Mr. Rosenkranz pointed us to a little while ago that said, once you have one of these, all of the chips are bought from the same source, and what was no evidence was anything to the contrary from your side. Now,
The instruction kept the jury from deciding where the sales were located.
That's a different point.
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is a properly instructed jury. You can't accept the trial record or its omissions without a proper instruction that gets the jury to see the relationship between any sales. In real life, in fact, the contracts in Santa Clara are subject to a lot of other contingencies, like whether there'll be contracts signed abroad. But, Your Honor, my key point is the instruction was erroneous, and I want to just go to the point about Mr. Rosenkranz said we didn't object to the but-for language of the instruction. That's incorrect. We strenuously objected to it. We proffered an alternative instruction that said solely resulting from the domestic infringing use. That was denied. So the instruction was incorrect, both as to excluding the extraterritorial chips and as to the weak standard of causation. And if you send it back, we could join. In this case, it was Marvell's burden, of course, to prove the damages. We were not given an opportunity to debate where the sales took place because they were all folded in. And so I would argue that we were effectively precluded. Your Honor, Judge Chen, you asked my friend, well, wouldn't AT&T versus Microsoft mean that if it was redone as a reasonable royalty case, all the foreign Windows sales would come in? And the answer is absolutely yes. He tried to say, oh, this is a causal nexus case, and there's no causal nexus in Microsoft. That's not true. The master document, the golden source in Microsoft, was, of course, causally related to all the foreign sales. He proves our point that this would have sweeping consequences if reasonable royalties could end-run territoriality by bringing in all foreign sales. Judge Wallach, you asked my friend, where's the evidence that the licenses for running royalties were comparable? There is none. Ms. Lawton, their expert, did not say that the running royalty licenses were comparable. And, in fact, our damages expert, Mr. Hoffman, said all were agreed they were not. The comparable licenses were all flat fee. And we're not saying the jury was bound to find a flat fee, but certainly where the delta is 600 to 6,000 times the jury verdict in this case, surely the historical licenses are probative of the unreasonableness of the jury award. And finally, two more, just quickly, Your Honor. Oh, you gave me 6 minutes, I'll slow down. Latches point, Your Honor. I'm Judge Toronto, we do think Latches, under the court's current law, warrants vacator here. This was a rare case in which her Latches ruling warrants vacator under current law. Her ruling...
Just on that, although not in the Latches ruling, I think later in time the district court said the only reason I denied Latches was willfulness. So in your view, Latches falls
with
willfulness.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. And if you look at her opinion, she says the only reason...
Latches. For a remand. That is, the district court might well, if the Latches doctrine survives, still be able on a remand to say...
put aside now willfulness, I still think that latches doesn't bar the pre-suit damages.
Well, Your Honor, in her ruling...
I don't see you get into a judgment of no pre-suit damages just because the district court said my reason was dependent on willfulness. If you took that out, the district court could come to the same conclusion on a different basis, possibly.
That is possible, Your Honor, but we would suggest that at a minimum you should remand because she found all elements of latches. The district court found that there was no causation under Sarah Darovic and that we didn't cause their delay. And therefore, the only ground was egregious conduct which equated with willfulness. If you throw out willfulness, you should throw out latches, and if anything, remand to see if there's some other equitable basis that can override the elements. We don't see that there can be. Everything about latches was coextensive with willfulness. It was all about actual knowledge and conscious.
So they stand or fall together?
They do. Well, we do. We believe if we went on willfulness, latches should go out. We
if
believe
we lose
you could
on willfulness, then
latches what? Should still go out because she found all the elements and
oh.
her. Yes, Your Honor, let me. Your Honor, let me explain. We believe we have an independent basis to throw out latches, even if you don't rule with us on willfulness, because egregious conduct must cause the delay. And she found, as a finding, that our supposed copying did not cause any delay.
What about the statements in Aukerman and Gasser Chair that your friend quoted that seem to suggest that there isn't necessarily a causation element between the unclean hands and the latches?
Your Honor, we think if that's in doubt, the proper remedy is remand here and let her see if she can come up with some sort of unclean hands that isn't dependent on willfulness. Last point, Your Honor, sigma is not constant. Column 10 uses the word greater. Mr. Rosenkranz is simply incorrect.
Word, I'm sorry.
Sigma is not
constant. No, uses the word greater.
Greater. Column 10, line 52. The fraction for the standard deviation for the transition noise is greater for the one branches than the zero branches.
But it's the same one you're using everywhere. It's not varying from time to time.
Correct, Your Honor. Right. But there's two functions, not one. Plurality is a set. With respect, Your Honor, you should reverse, at a minimum, remand for a new trial in which you'll guide the jury not to create sweeping extraterritorial reach, and in which the 50-cent chip, which is detailed in our brief, is redone for proper apportionment under this court's precedence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.